Where were you living during the war, and how old were you at the time?
I was 22 years old when I went in, and where I was living was near Emory, South Dakota, on a farm. Before I went, I was with the 134th Ordnance Company, and we were attached to a number of different units in overseas. We were attached to the 82nd Airborne, we were attached to 3rd Army, we were attached to 1st Army, and 3rd Army. That gives you an idea of how much we traveled around.
How aware were you of the war that was already going on overseas before Pearl Harbor?
I was in North Dakota at the time doing some work when the war started with England and France and Germany and Poland. I enlisted in 1942.
What prompted you to join the army?
Well, they were going to draft me, so I told the draft board, "They aren't going to draft me, I'm going to enlist." So I enlisted and got into a service I wanted to be in.
What kind of work did you do in the army?
Well, we did repair work. I was a head of the artillery department. We fixed artillery guns, the 105s, the 155s, the anti-aircraft guns, and that kind of guns.
Where were you stationed during the war?
Well, I was stationed in a number of different places, but I was stationed in mostly in Camp Shelby, Mississippi.
At what point during the war did you go overseas?
Well, we went overseas in 1944, in I believe it was in September, October, what's October, and we got over to we went to Boston POE, and from there we went to England, and then from England we went right over to France.
So, what did you do overseas?
Overseas, it was our duty to fix the artillery guns. When they broke down, they would bring them, and we would go out in the field and fix
Can you tell me about any prominent battles you were in?
them. Well, we was in the Battle of the Bulge. That was the biggest one, and the Battle of the Bulge was fought with in mostly in Belgium, and we were stationed along with the 82nd Airborne, and there was only one bridge that we could get across, and that was on foot towards at one point of the game or one point of the war. But the 82nd Airborne officers, "Don't worry about yourself, because we'll take care of you." They were a very good outfit.
Tell me about your family. How did the war change life for your family?
Well, my mom was very much, she was very, oh, as mothers are, she was very much concerned about her son being overseas and being in war. But, it was one of those things, what could you do?
Were you single then at the time you went over?
Yes, I was.
What became the high and the low points during the war?
Well, the high point was when the war ended. And the low point was when we were stationed overseas and in France. We were in France for about, 6 or 8 weeks, or even maybe longer, and it rained every day, and it was in a mud hole, and it was terrible living, in a pup tent. She had to sleep in a pup tent, and that was bad. But there was nothing you could do but live it out.
How long were you overseas for?
We were overseas a little over 9 months.
How long was your total service in the army?
3 years and 2 months.
Did the war change you?
Not really. I don't think it really changed me much.
When you think of your life during World War II, what things stand out most in your memory?
Well, we was always on reconnaissance. We were traveling so much because the army was moving forward after in the beginning of 1945. And so we were moving on upward towards Germany or even into Germany, and we were in Germany. And all of a sudden, one day, the lieutenant told me, or the captain told me and the lieutenant that we should go and find a new place for our outfit to set up. So we drove down the road, and all of a sudden we seen a place what was looked like a park, and we thought that'd be a great place for us to set up. So we drove in, and oh, that was a lovely place. Trees and green and just beautiful. So the lieutenant said, "I'll go back and get the company, and you stay here and look around." And when I started looking around, I seen there was eight engineers there, and they said, "We're leaving this place. It's a spooky place." So I looked around and I found an electric car, and I started driving in the underground passages. And all of a sudden, somebody hollered, "Kamerad, Kamerad, Kamerad!" And here was a German captain or officer with his wife and a little baby that wasn't possibly 2 weeks old. I don't think it was much older than that. It could have been a month, but I don't know. I never asked him how old it was. But anyway, he said, "I'm your prisoner." Well, what in the world did I want with a prisoner when I'm there all alone? I'd have to guard him. So I told him, "If you get out of this uniform and get lost and I don't see you again, I'll let you go." And oh, did he tell you? He was just tickled pink. Well, I started driving, they left, and the next morning, about 9 o'clock, after the company had come and we had set up, the captain, somebody come and called me that I should come real quick, that the captain wants to see me. So I went down to the captain, and here were 13 German officers or German workers, and they said it's for blast. That means it's everything's going to blow up. I looked at him and I says, "Was haben Sie hier? What you got here?" And he said, "We got nitroglycerin. This is the nitroglycerin factory." And I said, "What are you going to do with it?" Well, he said, "We want to burn it. And if we don't burn it in a couple days, it'll blow by itself." Because I had studied nitroglycerin while I was in the army and explosives, and I knew that nitroglycerin can blow by itself in 11 days. And so I told the captain, "Unless you better get some colonels down here or somebody down here that has the authority to let these guys burn it." So about an hour later, they called me again, and here were two colonels, and they started asking me questions. I said, "I don't even know them in English, much less in German." But anyway, I said, "These fellows have the know-how. You don't. And by the time you get people down here, it may be too late. And if you don't get them, I'm leaving, because I'm not going to stick around here and try to get blowed up." So they finally gave them 11 or them 13 engineers the go-ahead sign, and they made a paste that looked like my mother's when she made soap. She made the homemade soap, and that looked like that homemade soap brown, and they put that on boxes, and then they burned it. And that worked real fine. And so they did, after they did made about the fourth or fifth burn, then I left and let them guys go ahead and work, and they burned it before anything could happen. And this was the United States Air Force and the English Air Force had looked for this place for 5 years and never found it. It was that well hid.
And you just sort of found it on accident then.
We found it on accident. And if I wouldn't have been chasing down through the corridor, I maybe would have never. But being I was an interpreter for the outfit, that was the reason why I got involved with that.
So you were the German interpreter.
Yeah.
Do you have any interesting stories about that?
Well, I was a mayor of the city in Bavaria. I don't remember what the name of the city was. This is 64, 63 years ago. Anyway, he told me one day after about the second day that him and I were visiting burgomaster or the mayor of the town. He said there's a PW camp out here outside of town, and Patton went through and never found it. So I said, well, I'm going out to look at it. And he said, go ahead. He told me where it was, and I went to the captain. I told him he should go along, and he said, don't be so dumb. He said, there's nothing like that out there. Well, I said, that mayor told me there is, so I'm going to look. But I think you should come along. But he didn't. So we drove out there, and when we got out there, they opened the gate and let us drive in. And that was one mistake. Because these guys jumped on the Jeep and they started hugging us and everything else. And then I went through their cab barracks and looked at their barracks, and their barracks were pretty nice. They weren't that bad for the PW, the Air Force, the Luftwaffe. Therefore, and so that was an experience that I never will forget.
So how did you end up being mayor of a town?
Well, the captain appointed me. So that was kind of interesting. And after the war was over, the captain came to me and he says, say, he says, do you want a good job? Well, I said, if it's a good one, I'll take it. If it isn't, I don't want it. Well, he said, we're going to send you around to inspect all the German aircraft factories, which are so many of them are in houses, in the private homes. Well, I said, that sounds like a winner. So we did that for, at least a month. That was a lot of fun.
Do you have any interesting stories from that?
Well, not really. We'd go up to a house and we'd ask them if they have an airplane factory in there, and they'd say no. And I had to stuck the barrel of the gun in and says, I'm coming in to look anyway. And they, because we had a sheet where they about were. And so we knew that there was that they had something in. In some places they made the fuselages, in some places they made the wiring, in some places they made possibly the propellers, and in other places they made part of the wings, and so that was, and then they'd ship it all and assemble it.
So, did you find anything interesting?
Anything interesting? Oh, I found a lot of interesting things there, but we were in I got into a factory one day, what you call it, where they made binoculars. And when I got in there, I heard a terrible noise. So I rushed upstairs, and here the women were all fighting over the sugar and the salt. So I hollered like a wild bull. They all looked up, and they knew the American was there. And then I chased them all out of there. I said, if you would allow, wouldn't be fighting, I'd let you have some of that salt and sugar, but not now.
What did you believe at that time was at stake during the war?
Well, at stake was whether we could win the thing or not, because if we lose it, Germany will be overall. And this was Hitler's motto, Deutschland über alles. Deutschland over Germany over everything. That's what Hitler preached. And I could listen to Hitler's speech in 19, I think it was 36, and I could understand every word, but I can't talk that well German no more.
Do you still understand German pretty
Yes,
well?
I do pretty well.
Did you grow up in a German-speaking family?
Yes, my folks talk German most of the time. And so, but they could talk English too, and they lived in America, and so English was the language of America. But we had German church, we had German, talk German at home, and so German was a common language for us. And that came in very handy in the army.
Did you get any special privileges or perks being the translator of the group?
Not really. I just did it for our company, and we ran into a lot of these situations that we didn't really expect.
Did your war experience make you decide anything about the rest of your life?
Well, yes, it did. It kind of made me decide that I wanted to go back home and take up farming and get married, and that's what I did. In fact, when we got back from overseas, we got back, and it was a little after the 4th of July, and then on the 19th of July we got married. So I got married before the war ended. And then to tell you another thing, when I went back from recuperation leave is what they called it, we were headed for Japan, is where we were headed for. But anyway, when I got back to was going back to the army, they made us go to Camp McCoy, Wisconsin, which we never had been. And so we got to Camp McCoy, Wisconsin, and I told that officer, I said, "What in the world did you bring us here on a Friday when you know we ain't going anywhere till Monday or Tuesday? Why don't you give us a 3-day pass and let us go back home?" And he said, "You really want one?" I said, "Sure." So they wrote us out a pass. And when we got back to Minneapolis and got off the train, a little boy run by and he says, "The war is over." And we run all we could to get on a cab because that town went crazy. I tell you, I've never seen nothing like it because the war was over.
So what was that moment like? Can you describe
And
that?
that was great for us because then we figured we wouldn't have to go to Japan or to in that area. Well, Japan hadn't surrendered yet. Yeah, well, they had surrendered then.
Was it hard for you to transition back into civilian life after coming back from the war?
Not really. No, it wasn't.
Was it possible to put the war behind you completely, or did experiences kind of stay with you and influence who you
Well,
are?
the experiences stay with you for the rest of the life, but not that they really affected me, no.
Did you write home often?
Yes, I did.
Were you actually able to describe where you were and what was happening?
That you couldn't do. Everything they censored everything you wrote.
So what sort of things did you write about?
Well, I wrote about possibly where we were, or when I don't know if they censored that, but they would, tell mom and dad that we're doing pretty good and we're still getting along. And
What do you want people today to know about your experience and what you went through?
well, it's an experience you'll never forget, and an experience you really didn't want to live through. That's what I would say.
What were some of the best moments during the war?
The best moments were, well, when I was in Camp Hood, Texas, all of a sudden the captain, not the captain, but the lieutenant came around and he says, "I got a good job for you." I says, "What kind of a job you got now?" Well, he said, "I want you to be an instructor for the 105 howitzer to the anti-tank people." And so I did that. I did that for about 6 weeks. And so one day the major came around about once a week and would talk to me and to the class a little bit. And then one day he came and he says, "Say," he says, "I want to transfer you out of your outfit and into headquarters, and you'll be an instructor for the rest of the war." Well, I said, "That sounds like a winner." I says, "What are you going to give me?" I says, "I'm going to make you a sergeant." I was a tech sergeant, but I was one grade below that. Well, anyway, I said, "Then give me a week to think that over." And so I went back and laid in my bunk because I went to work at 8 and got off at 4. So that was really good hours. No KP, no guard duty, no nothing. And I was a PFC at the time. But here come the acting captain, Ted Correll, he was from Lake Andes, South Dakota. And he sat down on my bunk and he says, "Say," he said, "I hear they want to transfer you out." Boy, I says, "News travels fast." Well, he said, "I tell you what," he said, "you want to go with me?" I says, "Where are you going?" Well, he says, "We're going on Kadri, and you're going to miss the South Pacific." And I don't know how he knew that, but that I was with the 259 Ordnance Company at the time, media maintenance, and we were going to Camp Shelby. Well, I said, I'll tell you what, Lieutenant, I kind of liked him. He was a very nice guy, Lieutenant Correll. And so he, I told him, I'll go with you. And so the next day, I told that, or the next week, I told that major that I was going to go on Kadri. And then we went on Kadri. And so on one day, on I was a PFC on Tuesday. On Monday, they made me a corporal. On Tuesday, they made me a sergeant. On Thursday, they made me a staff sergeant. That's the one, the staff sergeant. And then that's what I was, a staff sergeant. It's unbelievable. You tell people that and they say, how in the world did you order that? I says, I didn't.
What else do you think we need to remember about World War II?
Well, World War II, if you take a look at what Hitler was trying to do, Hitler was trying to get a hold of the whole world. And for a little country that you could put inside of Texas and have a racetrack around the outside, it was unbelievable what they did. Unbelievable. They had, you know, when we got into Germany and got across the Rhine, the first thing we seen was the Autobahn. And the Autobahn is exactly the way our roads are here now, the freeways. They copied, or Eisenhower copied them to a T, the four-leaf clover to everything. And I had a fellow in my outfit who was a racetrack driver, a mechanic, and he took my Jeep one day and he said, I'll tune it up. So he tuned it up. Instead of going 60 miles an hour, it'd go 70. And so we'd go down the interstate and the cops were at order. We'd come behind us and we'd strike out and they couldn't catch us. We'd have a lot of fun with that.